Hey, good afternoon, everyone. The Appropriations Committee will come to order. Ms. Sherrill, would you please call the roll?
Chair Trumbull.
Here.
Vice Chair McClure. Representatives Alexander.
Here.
Avila.
Here.
Burden.
Here.
Burden. Bush.
Here.
Diamond, excuse. Drake.
Yes.
Ranking Member DuBose.
Here.
Duran.
Here.
Fine.
Here.
Geller.
Here.
Grawl.
Here.
Grant.
Here.
Angolia.
Here.
Jenny.
Here.
Latvala.
Here.
Leek.
Here.
Masullo, excused. Onfroy.
Here.
Perez.
Here.
Plakin.
Oh, here.
Placencia. Renner.
Here.
Roth.
Here.
Stevenson, excused. Tomko.
Here.
Wilhite.
Here.
Williams.
Here.
Williamson.
Here.
You have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Members, we have three bills on the agenda today. We're going to start with Chair Angolia to explain House Bill 7013, Technology Transparency. You're recognized, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Members, this bill addresses technology transparency. Addressing these critical issues is vitally important to our modern, heavily tech-dependent society. This legislation will allow Floridians to take back the virtual public square, a place where information and ideas should flow freely. Under our proposal, big tech social media firms must publish standards used to ban, post, deplatform users, or implementing shadow banning. Stop arbitrarily censoring and deplatforming users gives users the power to opt out of certain algorithms, stop frequent changes to terms of use, and clearly communicate and obtain prior consent to changes. Allow deplatformed users to retrieve all user information and provide equal access for established news organizations and qualified political candidates to reach users free of manipulation by algorithms. The bill also temporarily or permanently prevents social media platforms from contracting with state government if they are in violation of antitrust laws. And finally, the bill bans state and local governments from offering economic development financial incentives to companies that are in violation of antitrust laws. These changes, I believe, are needed now. The vast majority of Americans think that big tech is inappropriately censoring or failing to censor speech on their platforms. They can see that big tech makes up the rules as they go, and they fail to protect platform users from arbitrary, and that is the key, arbitrary actions. We need transparency, accountability, and consistency. That is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. There are no amendments. Members, are there any questions? Representative Geller, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Chair Angolia, for this very interesting bill. And we've talked about this at some of our earlier stops, so I just want to say it's not a question, but I do want to just start by thanking you and the staff for working to address some of the questions that were raised at the very first committee stop as a workshop. And I just think it's important for our proceedings to know that the processes do matter, that there are people here who listen and hear things and address issues. So while I still have trouble with the bill, I want to note that you made that extraordinary step and fixed some things about due process and the Attorney General. I think that's got to be noted in our proceedings. So thank you for that. Now, with that said, my question is, there are two, well, I have to turn around for a different face. So my two questions are, and you can answer them both in whatever way, you being a very smart guy. How do you address the concerns that we've raised about this being speech that's being compelled on the part of these private corporations? This compelled speech argument that has been raised that, you know, you've heard some about and had a chance to look at, and that it's basically compelling these platforms to adopt and sponsor speech that they find odious, and they're not a state actor. And secondly, how do you address the issues that those of us who think there is a problem with these platforms, and I don't support a lot of things they do, but how do you address the issues of Section 230 the federal law being what needs to be amended, and that the Supremacy Clause in Article 6 says that the federal government having adopted something to preempt this area, we may not act in contravention to what Section 230 says.
Mr. Chair.
You're recognized.
Thank you. So we've had some of these discussions before, and to help with the committee. The first thing I think everyone should realize is that I'm a believer, and I think many people on both sides believe that Section 230 really does need to be looked at a federal level. Having said that, that does not mean that we at the state level do not try to do things on our own if we can do it in conjunction with 230, but obviously we have to be subject to 230 because of the Supremacy Clause. All of that we get. But in this instance, there are things that Congress has not been able to do, won't do, refuses to do, that I think that we should do for Floridians, because they are the ones that are actually getting hurt, and our job is to protect Floridians. I think the key here is the way Section 230 is worded, and that it says that they can remove anything that is otherwise objectionable. So I know that you all probably received some communications from trade associations, and I don't think the trade associations even really get it. That is so subjective. It is an amazing amount of power that is given to these tech companies under 230, that being so subjective, they can do basically whatever they want. Whatever an algorithm that somebody actually writes, that is going to be subjective. Taking down somebody's platform, taking down a person because it's similar to another handle maybe that they've used. So the problem here is that we're faced with the challenge of what can we do in the state of Florida, and I think FDUPTA is a great way to go about this. Because we do think that, I think that it is unfair and deceptive trade practices. When you are asking somebody to sign onto a platform with the user agreement basically boils down to this: I am going to allow you to use my platform for free, and you then are going to basically give me a lot of information that I can use to market, remarket, lease out the data, where I'm going to make money off of you, okay? That's an agreement that they're having. But when you pull the plug on that user, and that user is a Floridian, I think the state has a compelling interest to step in and say, this is a one-sided transaction right now. As far as the compelled speech argument is, we're not compelling them to put anything up that would violate any standards that they publish. So if they publish saying that we are going to not host any hate speech or any call to riot, then that is now part of their standards that they would have to publish. And all we're saying is hold it to both sides. We're not saying, the compelled speech argument, I think, would say that since one person is saying this, you are now telling another group that they can also put that same to match that. That would be the compelling part. What we're saying is that if this doesn't match our guidelines, you got to take it down. But also, if this one doesn't match our guidelines, you have to take this down also. Treat both of them equally, publish the standards, hold everyone accountable.
Any other questions? Representative Fine, did you have a question? You're recognized.
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One question about the bill. Obviously, it probably is of great interest to all of us because, I mean, while I'm incredibly sympathetic to what you're doing, and I appreciate you doing this, as I understand it, the bill says a candidate for office cannot be deplatformed under the bill. So to give you a hypothetical, which isn't all that hypothetical, when I was running for office last year, I had a candidate who was running against me who said, Jews don't believe in God, and as a Jew, I should be exterminated. Now, Facebook didn't ban her because she didn't write something as egregious as being angry about the state legislature changing election law, but Facebook didn't ban her. But my point is, my question is, had this person continued to escalate it and said, you know, the Holocaust should have gone forth unmitigated, or, you know, let's bring back slavery, or whatever crazy comment a candidate running for office, the social media companies under this bill wouldn't be allowed to do anything as long as that person's a candidate for office?
You recognize?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. So that is one of the discussions that we currently are happening, that we are having, to see how we treat that specific scenario. You know, obviously, we would hope that a social media platform at that point would post as part of their governing document that you would not be allowed to post that. And if you were not a candidate, that would be taken down under the post. But we do understand, we are cognizant that the issue with it being a candidate, that's a different level within this proposed bill. So we are having discussions regarding specifically that. But I would also say that, racism, prejudicial comments, incitements to riots, anti-Semitic views really have no place in political discourse. But I would say that, you know, as a voter in your district, I would want to know that that person is making those comments, because that person would sure as hell never get my vote. And in the absence of seeing that, I think that also poses, and I think that's a discussion that we have to have also.
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. I wanted to kind of dive a little deeper into your presentation. You had mentioned in there that we want to take back the public square, and kind of wanted to hope you might be able to extrapolate a little bit more on what that means. What is the public square in a private entity's sphere?
You recognize?
Well, the first thing I would say is that the federal government has given them an immense set of powers under Section 230. So they are actually, they're giving these social media platforms the ability to regulate First Amendment and protected speech. And while I understand the genesis of wanting to do that, because they did not want to be held liable for what somebody would post, we've gotten to the point now where they've become so powerful, and some would argue, I'm not making this argument, some would argue that they act more like a utility and should be regulated as such. There's that argument out there that they become so powerful. But when you have a handful of companies that are so powerful that they can sort of dictate what can or cannot be seen or heard in order to make informed choices, I think that that is problematic. Now, we're talking about the medium that's being used, right? So in the old public square, you know, people used to, you know, get to a certain place in the community, and we used to listen to people. That's where stumping originally started. You cut down a stump, you get on a stump, you rise over everybody, and you pitch. There was no restrictions on that. But unfortunately, today, these companies have gotten so big, so large, and so powerful, that is the primary way, because of what's happening in the digital sphere, that that's the way the people get their information out. So, but what's also important to note here is that, and I'll draw the analogy to stumping on a speech, that when somebody would say something that is sort of against the guidelines, if you were in a debate, you would hold both parties accountable to that. That's all we're saying, is just publish the standards, hold both parties accountable. And another big part of this is to make sure that when somebody gets deplatformed or somebody gets censored, give them an explanation. Because right now, it's just they violated terms of user service, right? Which is just an amorphous document. You can't find out exactly what specifically you were deplatformed for. Let them know exactly what it is, so this way they can write the behavior, and let them know what portion of the standards that they published that they violated.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Rep. I want to follow up on this concept, trying to understand a little better. So a private entity by allowing you into their, you sign up to use their system for free, and you want to say, post messages and thoughts or opinions, et cetera, that because you, the agreement that you had mentioned of you're going to get X certain data, we're going to pull X data, and you're allowed to use our system for free, that that interaction, that I guess the transaction is something that provides a set of rights or a First Amendment right within this the system? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair.
No. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to equate it to one of the reasons why we would do something under the Fair Deceptive FDUPTA, right? Is that there is an inherent contract that you're affirming to when you're using a social media platform. And I was just verbalizing what that contract basically is. It is that you are allowing the platform to be used in exchange for the gathering of data, the gathering information for you to be marketed to or remarketed to. And that data is extremely valuable. These companies are some of the largest companies on the planet. And a lot of what they have is just data, right? So if you and I were in that sort of transaction, and I'm allowing you to take all of my information for the purposes of marketing, remarketing, targeting, micro-targeting, not just me, but people who think, look, act like me, for the purposes of making money, but I no longer have access to the platform, I think that's problematic.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir, one more.
Thank you. So I kind of wanted to understand, during your presentation, you also had mentioned and used the word arbitrary conduct to defend against arbitrary conduct. What are the lines? What does that mean?
You're recognized,
Chair. Whatever the social media company puts forth in their guidelines. So right now, arbitrary is purely arbitrary. It can change from the morning to the afternoon to the evening. So what we're saying is that publish your standards. Take the standards themselves would be arbitrary, obviously, because they would be writing their own standards, but just hold both sides to those arbitrary standards. So this way there's no arbitrary decisions being made only on one. They would have something to compare to.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate, Rep, your indulgence in going through this with me. I'm trying to understand. I couldn't see it in the analysis, and I tried to do my own research on it, but I couldn't find the number of Floridians who are getting the public square taken away from them. Do you have any idea what that volume, the number, the size of the situation and problem is?
Mr. Chair.
You're recognized.
I don't have an exact number, but it's a lot. And I will tell you that I get contacted on social media often about people who are being censored, put in what they would call social media jail for a certain amount of time. Their accounts have been deleted. Groups have been deleted. A lot of this is well documented. And I think one of the things that is really problematic to me from a looking out for my constituents sort of thing is that, and this happens, and if you check maybe your LA, if you check your own emails, I promise you, or social media, there are plenty of instances where your constituents, this has happened, where we have an older generation who is not extremely tech savvy, but they understand, you know, their phone and the app for social media. But they don't necessarily, and so when they take a picture and they upload it to social media of them and their grandkids, right, they think that that platform is there forever, ad infinitum. They can always get the pictures. They can always see the pictures of them and their grandkids. But all the hard photos are on their phone, and then they go, brand new phone, right? And they don't think of wiping out all the pictures. Why? Because it's in the cloud. It's on an app. I can get it. But now they get censored or deplatformed, or they get their account deleted, and they can never get any of those pictures back. That happens often. And there were people who have testified in a previous committee, members, that says that that's happened to them and their constituents. They get phone calls on this also.
Members, any other questions?
Representative Omfroy, you recognize?
Thank you very much, Chair. Representative Duran, I've had, it happened to me in 2016, and then I had two people within my district reach out to me during election cycle to tell me that their accounts were frozen based on them speaking about issues that they were concerned about. I talked about this in my last committee stop. It happens to people I know. These are not random people that I don't know. And my Facebook account, I had to actually reach out to the contact through the state to find out why I couldn't post information in 2018. So it's not something that doesn't happen to real people. It happened to me, and it happened to people that I know. So I just wanted to make sure I put that on the record.
Thank you very much. Let's try to keep questions in questions and debate in debate. Representative Wilhite, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chair Angoli, would this go to Chair Fine's comments about a candidate for office? If you're an incumbent the day you file, then you're a candidate. So would that include anybody that's an incumbent that is now a candidate or qualified for office?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Chairman. Chair Angoli, what if, how would you know, see, obviously this is a law dealing with Florida, not the feds, as you said. How would we know, or how would the platform know where you put your home of residence or where you're signed on the platform or where you're located to be able to fall under this guideline under the state of Florida as compared to any place else you have residence or that you arbitrarily put?
You recognize?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My guess would be two things. An algorithm that would be written in a combination with the second issue would probably be geofenced.
Any other members have any questions?
Last one, Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Do you have another one?
Okay. Yes, sir. I'm sorry. The last one, I had a question about, maybe this isn't as close because I know there's been certain platforms talked about, but for instance, like GoDaddy does a lot of campaign websites and you tie to that and different things, and it's obviously social media. Could someone then complain about your regular campaign website that you have that's not on that, everybody arbitrarily able to comment on that platform or website? If it's your website you've created for a campaign on GoDaddy, which is, you know, a larger corporation and owned, to be able to shut down your individual website then for your campaign? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chair Angoli, you're recognized.
Sorry, I just wanted to clarify. It would not meet, in that instance, it would not meet the description of social media technology company under the bill.
Members, any other questions? Seeing no more, we'll go to move to public testimony. First, we have Laura Loomer. Thank you very much for being here. You are recognized.
Hello, my name is Laura Loomer. I'm a Florida resident and a Florida small business owner. I'm honored to be here speaking with you today. Thank you for having me and allowing me to provide input into this evolving process. I'd also like to thank you for your consideration of House Bill 7013 to address the inequities by big tech and reiterate that this is a bold first step to ensure that the First Amendment rights of all Floridians are protected against the dangers that big tech poses to free speech. The issue of big tech censorship and deplatforming is very real for all people who utilize social media. I'd like to share with you a few examples of how being deplatformed has affected me and how it could potentially affect other Floridians. During Hurricane Dorian, which was set to land directly in Palm Beach County where I live, real-time emergency updates and life-saving information from the Governor's Office, the Division of Emergency Management, and the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office and the Weather Channel were being broadcasted on Twitter and Facebook. These are now the primary means of communications for these agencies. During the evacuation order, because I'm banned on both Twitter and Facebook, I was not able to get these emergency updates on social media, which is where most government agencies and governors now make their announcements. Additionally, Uber and Lyft were offering free rides to users for evacuation to hurricane shelters. I live in a hurricane evacuation zone, and I'm banned on both Uber and Lyft, and I was not able to utilize the service to get to a hurricane shelter. People without transportation who are deplatformed would not have been able and afforded a safe way to evacuate. As you can see, during a deadly hurricane or emergency, being deplatformed could potentially cost Floridians their lives. The first draft of this bill is welcomed, and I'd like to provide some points within the bill for consideration and improvement. Effective bills have three strong pillars: clear definitions, effective protections, and strong punitive enforcements. In its current draft, the bill does not address candidates who were previously banned and deplatformed prior to running for office, nor does it address current elected officials who could also be deplatformed. Further, the bill does not appear to address penalties for telecommunication companies and internet service provider companies that similarly have been known to deplatform candidates, people, and business owners for simply having an opinion. Second, when the bill defines journalist enterprises, it does not cover smaller independent journalists or freelance bloggers. The bill would only protect large, well-funded corporate media companies. Third, I strongly recommend that the bill include protection for individual citizens, candidates, and businesses from debanking to ensure that Floridians aren't arbitrarily banned from their banks and services like PayPal, Venmo, Cash App, GoFundMe, payment processors, modes of transportation, including Uber and Lyft, as well as food delivery services like Uber Eats. And lastly, I strongly recommend increased penalties against the offending big tech companies and deplatformers. The current penalties in the bill are not large enough, and they would not be deemed punitive or threatening to companies like Facebook, Twitter, Google, Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon, which are collectively worth trillions of dollars. All eyes are on Florida, the third most populated state in the nation. As Governor DeSantis has repeatedly emphasized, Florida is leading the way on addressing the issues of big tech censorship and deplatforming, and he has committed himself to protecting free speech. It's imperative that this bill be adopted in a manner that can be replicated and applied as flagship legislation in as many states as possible, but only if it's effective. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. As a proud Floridian, I look forward to working with all of you to make sure that this bill is the strongest and most effective legislation in the country against big tech censorship. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Loomer. Next, we have Cynthia Henderson. Waves in support, thank you. David Sardar. Not here. That does it for public testimony. Members, we are now in debate. Anyone wishing to debate the bill? Representative Geller, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really just want to begin by saying again to the sponsor that I appreciate that you have good intent on this, Chair Ngolia, and that I share some of your concerns about these big tech companies, and I think we do need to do something about them, and there's a problem there, and I think a lot of people on all sides of this process agree with that. So I don't question your bona fides on it, and again, I want to thank you for your willingness to address the legislation. Having said that, I really think, you know, sometimes I've argued on some of our bills that we're talking about something that ain't broke, so don't fix it. That's not the case here. This is broke. I just don't know that it's within our purview to fix it. I really do think that these issues of preemption by the federal government and the Supremacy Clause really make the approach we're taking ill-advised and probably, at least in my humble opinion, it makes it unconstitutional. I mean, it's Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution that talks about the, I have a little hand copy here. Thank you, Mr. Grimes, for that. We have to abide by the federal constitution. We could be sending a memorial to Congress that probably a lot of us could agree on, saying, please fix this, and ask people, again, on all sides of the process to do something. But these are very complicated issues. They impact our constitutional rights in a significant way. And the fact that some of what's going on is inappropriate or unfortunate, we know that free speech is measured by how odious speech is treated. There is a line You can say unpopular things just like you can think them. You can say horrendous things. But to go to the example that Representative Fine gave, there's a line between expressing an unpopular or even horrifying point of view and urging people to act on that in a way that violates the law and puts people at risk. That line should not be crossed, as we've seen it in recent events in this country. This is the Appropriations Committee. We've talked about this in Commerce, about how it will affect commerce, and I think it has a deleterious effect. And it will be talked about again in Judiciary about the constitutional issues. But from a fiscal point of view, not only will this private right of action create a multiplicity of spurious lawsuits, which is, by the way, maybe the most completely unnecessary part of this bill, it authorizes action by some governmental officials like our Attorney General. Authorizing a private right of action is a bad idea. But the other fiscal impact is going to be that once again, members, we're going to pass something that we have very strong reason to think is unconstitutional. We're going to spend tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to defend another unconstitutional bill that we've passed. Ultimately, we're probably going to lose. And the people who are going to pay are really not those of us sitting at these tables. It's going to be the taxpayers who pay. So I'm against the bill on the Supremacy Clause grounds. I'm against the bill because I think it does interfere with the free speech rights of private entities. And as long as we have something that says that these corporations are entitled to be treated for free speech purposes as if they were people, that's a bad idea as expressed in Citizens United, but it is the law of our land. This law interferes with private free speech rights. As such, I know that the First Amendment Foundation has expressed concern about it for that reason. I join that concern. And regrettably, I must be in opposition to it today and ask you to join me in that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Omfroy in debate.
Thank you very much, Chair. On January 17th, at 3:57 p.m., I received a text message from Will. I changed his name. It said, "My page has been taken." I said, "What? My Facebook page is removed permanently. Did they warn you?" "No, because they keep changing up their policy, so all they have to say that you violated the community rules." My response, "Permanently though? Yeah, I believe so." This happens to everyday people often. On my Twitter page just today, I have one of the people that I follow that has over 100,000 people that follows them, and they're talking about the fact that one of their other pages was literally. This is a prime example of Twitter moderation that allows slurs like this to run rampant, but my account was suspended for saying one word. So this is a real reality for people, and I don't agree with maybe a lot of things sometimes that come before me. But on this one, I know that I had to reach out to, once I got elected to office, I reached out to the Facebook contact and asked them why my messages that I was trying to post couldn't be posted. Miraculously, after I got elected, they started being postable again. So I thank you for this legislation. I believe that it's important to know what parameters we're navigating through. And I disagree with my colleagues in regards to saying that we shouldn't take this on. I believe that people should know what they're getting when they go on a platform. I believe that it should be open and transparent. And I think that that's what we're pushing for. And I'm grateful for this legislation because I'm tired of getting these messages and I can't help anybody with it.
Thank you, Representative Wilhite. Oh, you're good? Okay. Representative Fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Look, I appreciate this bill coming forward because, as Representative Amfori said, I get constant contacts from my constituents being banned or blocked or whatever for things that oftentimes don't make any sense. I had a constituent just email me yesterday about being banned for weeks because she asked about how much ammo she could buy for a certain amount of money. Apparently, that was some sort of call to violence. She was just looking to buy ammunition for her gun, and that was some sort of call to violence. And the challenge becomes there's this viewpoint discrimination where some things are okay to say and some things aren't, and it's a real problem. This affects our citizens, I think, more than many of the things that we get contacted about. I don't get contacted by most of the issues that we debate here in the legislature where people are actually telling me, regular people, that they have problems with it. This is one that I do, and this is one of the things that I get contacted about most. This is how people get their information. I think for many of us, social media is probably the primary way that we communicate. We may do newsletters now, but I can tell you, for every one person that gets one of my newsletters that I send out every week, 50 are getting that information from me through social media. And look, while the federal, I don't want to wait on the federal government. They don't seem to be able to do anything. I think we have an obligation to our constituents to do what we can. The one caution I have, and the reason I chose to speak on this, is a bill this long and this complex has to be thought through and has to be considered for unintended consequences. We all became candidates for the Florida legislature. We had to fill out two pieces of paper. We didn't even have to get anything notarized. And my concern is not about actual candidates. My concern is about potential candidates, about crazy people. Nazis and child molesters and pedophiles who realize they can say anything they want. And by the way, it can't even be deprioritized under this bill. It's got to be at the top of the page if all they do is fill out those two pieces of paper. So we have to fix this problem, and I applaud you for doing it, but we have to make sure in fixing it, we don't create an even bigger problem. I can't tell you what I went through having to deal with someone who literally, my kids got asked about, you know, Daddy, why do people think we should be exterminated? That didn't get taken down, but I think if that person can say that, there's a whole host of other crazies that would come aboard and say those things as well. So I'm excited to vote for this bill today, and I'm excited about seeing how it continues to evolve as it moves through the process.
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to go ahead and vote down on this bill today. I have a lot of concerns. It is undoubtedly unconstitutional, and so on the appropriations, with my appropriations hat on here, not only is our Attorney General going to spin her wheels spending money defending this, but there's going to be hundreds, if not thousands, of lawsuits in our court system over this issue, and it's going to bog down our court system. So it's interesting to hear us talk about that here, and in other places, we are very concerned about the bogging down our court system with cases and unnecessary litigation. I want to talk a little bit about this First Amendment issue that we are just kind of skirting around. We're talking about a private business that is, content moderation is a form of free speech. And what we are doing is saying that you no longer, a private entity who provides a free, no one is required to communicate on these platforms. You have willingly gone and acquiesced to go onto that platform. You willingly put your pictures and your content and your opinions onto that platform. That does not mean that that private entity has any requirement to not be able to remove that content if they don't believe it's correct, no matter what it is that they say. And so what we are saying here is that that does not matter. And we're pointing it out to a certain type of business. Specific businesses. We are carving businesses out. This, if you put your hat on it, if you think about this, what happens if that community coffee house who has a little area that they allow people to play music or even come up there and talk, they can sign up on the board that they want to go and use that stage, and some come up there and say whatever the heck it is that they want. It might be nasty, it might be political, and it might be completely against your opinions. The coffee house has a little board in front that they can put newspaper articles. If they don't like any of those things, they can take them down. What happens when we get to that step, when we don't like what our private businesses in the community are starting to say, or they use content moderation in order for them to believe what they believe is correct, because that's their right as an entity. We are beginning to carve out. And that, to me, really goes against, I mean, I'm not going to tell you all about free enterprise and the ideas of market and small government, but this seems to go quite the opposite of that. The unintended consequences are this. If Facebook knows that they're going to have thousands of lawsuits against them, or Twitter, because they have been, someone has been deplatformed because they have used their right of content moderation, they're now going to be, they're just going to let everything go. We got to be careful. And so what we might begin to see are, in some ways and avenues, child pornography and all these other things that we do not want folks to see, and that they actually are thousands of times a day probably moderating out of our viewing sphere. And then finally, what is to stop Facebook, Twitter, or any of these companies from saying, you know what, this is too difficult for me, I'm closing down shop. You saw what they did in Australia. Why wouldn't they do the same here in the state of Florida? So if you think you're getting calls right now because you have, because that your, somebody's rights, First Amendment rights, are being violated, think about what's going to happen when Facebook says, forget it, this is too difficult a state to do businesses. How about the tens of thousands, if probably not more, of businesses in the state of Florida that use Facebook to advertise their business? They're going to call you when that happens, when Facebook says or Twitter says, nah, this is too much. So I have strong reservations with the policy being proposed. There are some good pieces in here. The antitrust regulations and proposals are a good place to be. I think that we need to be going down that path. But we cannot change Section 230, and we cannot skirt around the First Amendment. And I think that that's the problem with this bill. It has fatal flaws.
Anybody else wishing to debate? Seeing no more debate, Representative Ngolia, you're recognized to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank everybody for the feedback on the bill. Obviously, most bills, as they work through the committee process, are a work in progress. And we listen to a lot of the feedback. Having said that, I just want to address a couple of things because, you know, I think some things really need to be pointed out here. There was a question that was brought up about what happens if you had a person that was, you know, deplatformed or if they're taken away. I just want to bring this up as an example. So right now, a lot of these social media companies are deplatforming or censoring anybody that puts out any misinformation regarding COVID-19. And I think that it's, that's sort of like the standard right now. But let's think back to February of 2020, when Dr. Fauci said that we don't need masks, right? So if somebody retweeted that or shared that on Facebook, in today, you would be viewed as spreading misinformation about COVID-19. And this is coming from the chief epidemiologist for the United States. So that's some of the things that are concerning. That person could be deplatformed. Although the bar is sort of moved from February 2020 to March 2021, but I think we all get the sentiment. What happens if that person was deplatformed? What happens if that person was censored? And all they're doing is basically putting out the information was, at that time, the information of the day. So, and that goes to part of the subjectivity of what we're talking about here. What we're trying to do is create a level playing field. Now, granted, we have a supremacy clause, we have Section 230, which has, you know, but the federal government isn't doing anything. I think there are parts of this bill that we can implement. And look, at one day, this may be adjudicated, and that's why there's a severability clause in here, to make sure that the parts that stand will be able to stand. Having said that, there are still things that I think that we need to look at. I think we need to look at the dollar amount of the fines. That's a discussion that we can have. The ISP's comment was thought about debanking. I think that is a very real concern that we should be looking into. At the end of the day, this bill is about protecting Floridians when the federal government is failing to do so. We're creating a level playing field, a predictable playing field, by publishing the standards and hold everybody accountable. That's what this bill does. And with that, I close, Mr. Chair.
Having closed on this bill, Ms. Sherrill, would you please call the roll?
Chair Trumbull?
Yes.
Vice Chair McClure?
Yes.
Representatives Alexander?
No.
Avila?
Yes.
Burton?
Yes.
Bush?
Yes.
Diamond? Drake?
Yes.
Ranking Member DeBose?
No.
Duran?
No.
Fine?
Yes.
Geller?
No.
Grawl?
Yes.
Grant?
Yes.
Engolia?
Yes.
Jenny?
No.
Latvala?
Yes.
Leek?
Yes.
Masullo? Umfroy?
Yes.
Perez?
Yes.
Placon?
Yes.
Placencia?
No.
Renner?
Yes.
Roth?
Yes.
Stevenson? Tomco?
Yes.
Wilhite?
No.
Williams?
No.
Williamson?
Yes.
19 yeas, 8 nays.
Thank you very much. We will show House Bill 7013 reported favorably. Next, we'll move on to Representative Costello. You are recognized to explain House Bill 79, Purple Heart.
Thank you, Chair, committee members, for hearing this bill. I filed this legislation with my friend, Representative Matt Wilhite, in hopes of saving lives. This bill establishes the Purple Alert, which can be activated when an individual who falls on parameters set forth, which includes those with mental, cognitive, intellectual, and developmental disability, or one with a brain injury, or another mental, physical, or emotional disability that is not related to substance abuse, who goes missing and whose disappearance is a credible threat of immediate danger or serious bodily harm to themselves. This bill was inspired by the family and friends of a Joshua Marshall, a 30-year-old Port St. Lucie man who was nonverbal and autistic, and was found dead in August of 2018 in a pond near where he lived. And I would like to share his story, if I may. Joshua became disabled when he was 14 months old due to a virus that caused heart failure and lack of oxygen to his brain. Joshua and his father had just moved to Port St. Lucie. He had been there just over a week. Josh wandered from the house late at night. He wandered for a while and found his way to a 7-Eleven gas station. He was there for well over an hour. He cannot ask for help, as he did not speak or write. The workers in the store had no idea who he was or why he was out front. People saw him wearing no shoes, walking with a lopsided gait due to his disability, and he was distraught. They assumed he had been drinking. They completely misread the situation. He was crying and barefoot and no one to help. They did not know that he was disabled. They did not know he desperately needed help. He finally wandered across a busy intersection to a fire station with a pond, and Josh was very attracted to water and walked right into that pond, which is about 30 feet from the fire station, and he drowned. This is why the Purple Alert is very important, helping that segment of population of those like Joshua Marshall. This alert would function similar to the Silver Alert, which typically covers those over 60, and we associate with silver hair, and the Amber Alert, which covers those under 18. The Purple Alert covers the subset of individuals who do not fall under criteria of other established alert plans, such as autism and Down syndrome. This bill requires the FDLE to establish and implement this alert and to work with the FDOT and the DHSMV, the Department of Lottery and local law enforcement, to broadcast information to the public and media about these missing adults. This can be through lottery terminals, activation of message signs on state highways, and through cellular alerts to subscribers. These alerts can be targeted to geographic areas with the jurisdiction so as to focus on the area where the missing adult is believed to be. In an effort to maintain the independence, the privacy, and dignity of a missing adult, the dissemination of sensitive health or diagnosis information would not be used unless absolutely necessary. In addition, the alert should be activated when sufficient descriptive information and the circumstances surrounding disappearance are available. I might add that this bill is supported by the AARP, Disability Rights of Florida, and the Florida Developmental Disabilities Council, and the Florida State Guardianship Association. And I thank you, Chair, for hearing this bill. There's also an amendment on this bill, Chair.
Yes, sir. You're recognized to explain Amendment 1.
Well, thank you so much, Chair. And I'd like to say a thank you to staff for investigating this and bringing this forward. The amendment changes the funding source of the General Revenue Fund to the Operating Trust Fund with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, as that was identified as the proper place from which to withdraw revenue of this project. The amendment makes adjustments to the non-recurring appropriations being provided and the full-time equivalent position, which are authorized for completing any additional workload created by the provisions in this bill. The upshot here is that staff found out that we would be able to make this bill less expensive and more efficient. And that's the amendment, Chair.
Having explained the amendment, members, are there any questions on the amendment? Seeing no questions, we do not have any public testimony on the amendment. Members, any debate? Seeing no debate on the amendment, you're recognized to close.
I would waive my close, Chair.
Having waived close, we will show that. All those in favor of the adoption of the amendment signify by saying yay.
Yay.
Opposed, no. We'll show that amendment adopted. Members, are there any questions on the bill? Representative Plakin, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Of course, legislation that I thought would help people with Alzheimer's, I'm usually for it. But I had a couple questions about this bill in particular. I think something like this came a couple years ago, and I was involved in some back and forth with FDLE, and there was concern about too many alerts, which could ultimately cause white noise and make them all less effective. And I've been told that some states have started contracting the number of alerts for that reason. Could you comment on that?
Yes. You know, I guess the question could be is that why don't we just wrap this under the silver alert? Would that be? And I would say the same reason why we don't bundle the amber and the silver alert together. Creating a purple alert allows us focus where we see silver. You'd think silver here and 30. As Joshua Marshall was, I see the, you know, as Joshua Marshall was. And I see the argument that we shouldn't create too many different colors, as it would confuse people, but I'm confident that we can get a hold on three. We are currently in talk with the Alzheimer's Association on potential amendments to prevent this confusion as it would be put into effect.
Follow up, yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second concern is I looked at the FDLE website, and the staff analysis seems to suggest that the silver alert would perhaps not cover people under 60 with the type of situation we're talking about. But on the FDL website, it says, if the person is 60 years or older is a criteria for the silver alert, or the person is 18 to 59 and law enforcement has determined that the missing person lacks the capacity to consent and that the use of dynamic message signs might be the only way to rescue the missing person. And number three, the person must have irreversible deterioration of faculties that has been verified by law enforcement. So can you, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but the staff analysis seems to suggest one thing and the FDLE site the other thing, and how can we reconcile those things?
And that's a good question, Representative. And it's true that under current protocol, people under 60 can qualify to receive an alert if they match the criteria and if they have an irreversible deterioration of intellectual facilities that we typically associate with the aging, such as Alzheimer's or dementia. But this bill fills the gaps on issues that don't match that, such as the autism or Down syndrome.
Good. Any other questions? Seeing no other questions, we'll move to public testimony. Etta Fernandez, AARP, says they waive in support. That does it for public testimony, members. We are now in debate. Anyone wishing to debate? Representative Plakin, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree that wandering is a very big problem for these populations. I know the existing members, but some of the new members, I was married to Susie for 33 years, and she contracted Alzheimer's the last 4 years of her life, and wandering was a big problem. One time, I came home from work, and my mother-in-law and my son were there. I said, "Where's Susie?" They just
you looked away for a moment. We found her about 15 houses away, thankfully, and she was in someone's house doing their dishes. And they asked her name, and she couldn't pronounce her name. It's, instead of Plakin, she said they thought it was Lincoln. And in that case, it was the neighborhood app. Somebody recognized, knew that. I acknowledge, and I think we'd stipulate, it's a big problem with these people that wander, and these systems are very, very valuable. Some of the concerns I had that I sort of discussed during questions, I'm going to be a yes vote today, but I'm still not fully understanding why we need to create this new law, so to speak, versus just sort of tweaking the Silver Alert statute to make sure that this is more clear. There does seem to be lack of clarity here, so I think it does need to be made clear. I'm just not sure that this is the best approach to do it. So I'll be voting yes, but I'm on judiciary, so I'd like to talk to you before judiciary and see if we can get this in a little better form. Thank you.
And,
sir,
Chair, we're at me.
Representative Wilhite, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Representative, for this, because we know the safest and most logical place for someone is that has a memory problem or disorder or intellectual disability is with their family and the surroundings that they feel the most comfortable. And so getting them back there as soon as possible is the best thing we can do for them. But it also sets the family member that they're separated from at ease. And I'd say a little bit about the different kind of alerts. I would say that when you look at an alert, sometimes they're geared towards geographical areas. If you live in a senior community, you may not have as much heightened awareness for an Amber Alert. And the same thing with a Silver Alert. They're senior communities. So it's this most logical area around them where some of those alerts were. Now, this purple alert could be anywhere because it could be anybody. So I don't think we're getting too far out of the realm of how many. I think we all have gotten the idea that when our phone goes off, when it's a Silver Alert or an Amber Alert, we look at it immediately. And time is not just money. Time is life. Because as you said, had that young man been found earlier, maybe he would be alive today. But because law enforcement balances the idea of someone truly being missing or just separated, this one puts the idea in place before they call an alert or consider someone missing. This one puts into place specifically that someone does have a brain disorder, that isn't thinking logical, that isn't probably doing this on their own. And so I think this is probably, I think it's logical to have this because of the overreaching that it does, because it goes into all those other areas of the Silver Alert. So I think it's a good piece of legislation. I think, as Chair Engolia said, everything can be tweaked and worked on. And I believe that we will do that. And hopefully, as it goes through the process, it gets even better. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else wishing to debate? Representative Bowes, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to start by thanking you for bringing this good legislation. And Representative Plakin, I think the bill you may be referring to is a bill that I filed back in 2017, the TJ Alert. And it was for a young man who had went missing. And for 2 days, the family was looking for him. And he just didn't have the capacity to communicate. Like, there were reports of a young black male knocking on the door, and they opened the door, just find him unresponsive. He was in a certain state, had nothing to do with drugs or anything. It's just more mental capacity. And I'm sitting here and listening to this bill. And so ran into some of the similar challenges about too many and not enough, and feeling convicted here for not pushing harder, because now learning what happened in 2018 makes me feel convicted about the legislation that I was working on. And to Representative Wilhite's point, we need to make room for this legislation, because at the end of the day, we can't fall on too many, alerts or whatever the case may be, and it results in the death of an individual. So I want to commend you for bringing this forward. I definitely support it, and I encourage all of my colleagues to support this legislation. And if there is room to make it somewhat better, as Representative Plakin stated, I think we should work in that direction. But let's please move this legislation forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no more debate, you're recognized to close, Representative.
Thank you, Chair. And I would say, Representative Flaken, we will be having that discussion, and I appreciate you reaching out to me, bending some of your concerns going down the road here, and we'll have that conversation, I promise. I waive the close.
Having closed on the bill, Ms. Sherrill, please call the roll.
Chair Trumbull?
Yes.
Vice Chair McClure?
Yes.
Representatives Alexander?
Yes.
Avila?
Yes.
Burton?
Yes.
Bush?
Yes.
Diamond? Drake?
Yes.
Ranking Member DuBose?
Yes.
Durand?
Yes.
Fine?
Yes.
Geller?
Yes.
Grawl?
Yes.
Grant?
Yes.
Engolia?
Yes.
Jenny?
Yes.
Latvala?
Yes.
Leek?
Yes.
Masullo? Umfroy?
Yes.
Perez?
Yes.
Flaken?
Yes.
Placencia?
Yes.
Renner?
Yes.
Roth?
Yes.
Stevenson? Tomko?
Yes.
Wilhite?
Yes.
Williams?
Yes.
Williamson?
Yes.
27 yeas through zero nays.
Very good. We'll show House Bill 79 reported favorably. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Committee.
Next, we'll move to Representative Drake, House Bill 323.
Thank you, Chairman Trumbull. Members, many of you are familiar with how license plates are authorized into law, and in the process of doing so, language is usually inserted into the bill that does that to allow for the investment of the monies that are held in trust. However, there are six funds that FWC hold in trust that were not authorized the investment of those monies. This bill will fix that. It also allows for the use of some of the monies to be used on the investment for admin costs. That's the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Having explained the bill, there are no amendments. Members, any questions? Seeing no questions, we'll move to public testimony. Charlotte Jarrett, FWC. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank our sponsor for carrying the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
I think we're good. Any questions? Very good. We'll move on. Members, we're in debate. Anyone wishing to? Representative Geller, do you have a question, or did you want to debate?
No, debate.
Okay, yes, sir. You're recognizing debate.
I just want to thank my friend Rep. Drake for bringing this bill. I know it seems technical to some, but the result is our water will be cleaner and will help to preserve wild Florida. Those are great things, and a little bill like this goes a long way. So thank you, Rep. Drake.
Anyone else wishing to debate? Seeing none, Chair Drake, you're recognized to close.
Wave close.
Mr. Sherrill, please call the roll.
Chair Trumbull?
Yes.
Vice Chair McClure?
Yes.
Representatives Alexander?
Yes.
Avila?
Yes.
Burton?
Yes.
Bush?
Yes.
Diamond? Drake?
Yes.
Ranking Member DuBose?
Yes.
Durand?
Yes.
Fine?
Yes.
Geller?
Yes.
Grawl?
Yes.
Grant?
Yes.
Engolia?
Yes.
Engolia?
Yes.
Yes. Jenny?
Yes.
Latvala?
Yes.
Leek?
Yes.
Masullo? Umfroy?
Yes.
Perez?
Yes.
Flaken?
Yes.
Placencia?
Yes.
Renner?
Yes.
Roth?
Yes.
Stevenson? Tomko?
Yes.
Wilhite?
Yes.
Williams?
Yes.
Williamson?
Yes.
27 yeas, zero nays.
Very good. We'll show House Bill 323 reported favorably. Everybody, that does it for today's agenda. Seeing no other business for the agenda, Representative Alexander moves to rise without objection. See y'all next week.